Good afternoon. It's 12:06 and time for Health 360 Midday Matters on WBOY 89.1 FM. We hope that we hear from you today during our conversation. The number to call is 260-452-1185. You can always email us at middaymatters@nipr.fm or post right on our Facebook page, Midday Matters. I'm Sarah D'Elia, joined in the studio by my co-host, Dr. Peter Rothman.
Thank you, Sarah. Today we'll be discussing multiple sclerosis, symptoms, diagnosis, and treatment. Multiple sclerosis is a chronic immune-mediated, progressive, variable, unpredictable, and often disabling disease that attacks the central nervous system. 2.1 million people in the world have multiple sclerosis, including 400,000 Americans. While the exact cause of multiple sclerosis is not clear, it appears to be the result of a complex interaction of genetic susceptibility and possible environmental and/or viral triggers. Although not curable at this time, new diagnostic and therapeutic techniques, medications, and rehabilitation programs are now available to decrease the severity, progression, and functional disability of MS, greatly enhancing the quality of life of multiple sclerosis patients. Here to increase our understanding and awareness of multiple sclerosis and newer treatment options available are neurologist Dr. A.J. Gupta and neuropsychologist Dr. Ron Williams of the Fort Wayne Neurological Center's Multiple Sclerosis Institute that serves 2,000 multiple sclerosis patients in Indiana and our adjacent states. Welcome, Dr. Gupta and Williams.
Thank you for having us.
Good afternoon.
Dr. Gupta, what precisely is multiple sclerosis, and what are the possible causes and triggers of this disease?
The best way to define multiple sclerosis would be to say that it is either autoimmune or immune-mediated disorder of the central nervous system. It is chronic, it is progressive, and it has a predilection for affecting women over men. So in the vast majority of patients, the disease will progress even with modern treatments. The emphasis on early treatment of MS is simply to give patients the greatest quality of life for the longest period of time. An exact cause of MS is not understood, but we believe that it is an interplay between genetics, environment, and the immune system.
And about what age do people start discovering, or what age does the disease start presenting itself?
The typical age group is 18 to 55 or 18 to 60. We have a population of patients that are younger than 18 and in their teen years that develop multiple sclerosis. It is rare or uncommon to have multiple sclerosis beyond the age of 60, although there are patients that are diagnosed for the first time in an older age group.
And what role, there's been mentioned through the years of geographical distribution, distance from the equator, certain geographical clusters throughout the world. What role does geography possibly play in this? And once a person has a genetic predisposition, what role would environmental exposures and possibly infection play?
Yeah, so this is a disease of temperate climate. As you move away from the equator, the disease is more common and frequent. Today, we talk a great deal about exposure to sun and vitamin D levels, and that is believed to be one of the hypotheses. On the human chromosome, the genes for vitamin D are closely related to those that confer susceptibility to MS and those that may be involved in immune mediation. So it appears that there is a complex interplay of these different genes. A study done in Switzerland found that those that lived up in the mountains and had a fair amount of exposure to sunlight had a lower incidence of MS than those that lived in the valley, where because of the cloud cover, there was less exposure to sun and therefore a higher risk for MS. So we definitely think that environment and sunlight and perhaps vitamin D play a role in initiating the disease process or causing it. And then there is always a question of infections. As you know, over the years, we have identified any number of viruses that have been thought to cause MS or initiate the immune response. The latest one and the one that has been most investigated is the Epstein-Barr virus. There are strong studies in pediatric patients where Epstein-Barr virus has been implicated in causing a relapse of MS or causing a worsening of MS. This has not been found true in the adult population. So we think that the viruses or any number of these viruses that are neurotropic viruses that have an affinity for the nervous system may initiate an immune response. And then antibodies are generated which are similar in structure to the nervous tissue and the subsequent damage occurs.
And the damage occurs to the myelin sheath that surrounds the nerves?
Yeah, it occurs to the myelin sheath. It occurs to the oligodendrocytes. These are the cells that produce the myelin sheath. And it also occurs to the neurons, the structure. So it is a more complex pathology than simply a demyelinating disease. It would not be fair to say that MS is purely a demyelinating disease.
You are listening to Health 360 Midday Matters on WBOY 89.1 FM. And if you have a question or comment, we're talking about multiple sclerosis here on the program, dedicating the whole hour to signs, symptoms, and treatment of it. And if you have a question, we'd love to hear from you, 260-452-1185. And remember, you can always email us anonymously at middaymatters@nipr.fm, or you can post on our Facebook page. It's Midday Matters. I wanted to ask, let's walk somebody through who may feel like they've been having symptoms of multiple sclerosis. What are those symptoms? I mean, it's interesting because you can be a young person and develop this disease, or you can be an older person and develop it. So what should folks be wary of if they start to develop certain symptoms that they might need to go to the doctor?
So the symptoms are multifold. Starting with a variety of numbness and tingling in different parts of the body, weakness, incoordination, excessive fatigue, even forgetfulness and mood changes occur in early MS. So if there are a whole host of symptoms, and I forgot to mention bladder dysfunction and bowel problems, then you need to start thinking about MS.
Does family, if you're somebody who has a family history of MS, should you be cognizant of that and keep that, you know, are you more at risk because of that family history at all? Is there any information about that?
Yes. If there is a family history, it increases your risks for MS, but it's not a single gene disease. It's a polygenic disease. And the information, and to put it in perspective, if you look at studies done in twins. Mm-hmm. In monozygotic twins, the risk of MS in so-called healthy twin is 30%. So if it was a strictly genetic disorder, you would expect that the so-called healthy twin would have a very high risk of MS. But it is only 30%, even in monozygotic studies. Mm-hmm. So there is 70% of twin that does not develop or show signs of MS. Mm-hmm. So it increases your risk if a family member has MS, but by no means suggests that every one of the children will develop the disease.
I think it's been stated that 1 in 750 people have MS, but if you have a first-degree relative, it's like 1 in 40. There's increased chances, but it's not, as you're saying, it's not directly genetically transmitted.
Correct. I mean, I've not come across some of those figures that you mentioned, but...
We have a caller on the line. Tim from Indianapolis has a couple of friends who have MS, and they're wondering about different percentages of sufferers being women, if more women are susceptible to MS, which we touched on briefly a little bit, and some of their family or some of the their health history. Let's get Tim on the line now so he can ask the question himself. Tim, welcome to Health 360.
Thank you.
You can go on with your question.
I have two friends that are both women that suffer from MS, and one was diagnosed 25 or maybe almost 30 years ago now, and she had been a nurse in her younger years. And she told me that there was a large majority percentage of sufferers that were women. She, you know, she asked her doctor at the time a lot of questions. And she also told me that of those women, it had been found that many had been abused as children, and they thought that that might be a contributing consideration at that time. And I didn't know if that was still a consideration today. And I will take my answer off the phone line.
Thanks for your question. That's an interesting one, Tim. Dr. Gupta, any information behind that?
I'm not aware of any association between child abuse, whether physical or emotional, and MS.
Okay.
And Dr. Williams, while stress has been mentioned in the past, there really isn't much evidence to show that stress can at least initiate MS.
No, I don't think there's any evidence that it directly initiates or causes the disorder. I think what may be happening sometimes are there are other factors causing cognitive problems, emotional problems that may get tangled up in the symptom picture as a result of stressful things in the person's life, or maybe historically the person comes from a bad family where abuse took place, and maybe there are other factors that just correlate with it, not necessarily causative.
But the disease itself can contribute to depression, mood change. Is this? Do you see this in your cases?
Certainly, the disease itself can contribute to chemical changes at the brain level that can cause depression and other cognitive or mental health problems. Naturally, as with any chronic illness affecting ability, there are going to be adjustment issues that would lead to depression as well. I think only recently have we really begun to pay close attention to the cognitive changes that are associated with this disease. As with anything, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. The thing that you most easily see, the physical changes, are the ones that get the attention. Mm-hmm. And just recently, are we paying more attention to the cognitive changes that come along with this disease, sometimes very early on?
The early presentation, when it first comes on, there's something called a clinically isolated syndrome. Could you tell us how it presents, the symptoms, and when does it start to progress or not?
So clinically isolated syndrome is what we consider a pre-MS state. And it is one where a patient may experience a dimness of vision in one eye or both eyes, and there is loss of color vision. This is a condition called acute optic neuritis, which is a classic symptom of MS. Another symptom is where weakness and numbness develops in the legs and gradually ascends up to the waist, and you have problems with bladder or bowel and walking. This syndrome is called transverse myelitis. So these are very characteristic symptom complexes that give rise to a strong suspicion of MS, and then patients are put through a battery of tests that either shows that they are indeed showing the typical features of MS and at risk for developing a full-blown disease if they're not treated early. And patients can get other syndromes that we call brainstem syndromes in MS, which are also considered clinically isolated syndrome.
But when they have this first symptom, and it may be self-limiting and go away, but they really should be evaluated.
Absolutely, because the emphasis is on early identification of MS and treatment. So if we do a variety of laboratory studies, including spinal tap and MRI scans and various blood tests, and if all of that data seems to show that, yes, this patient is at risk and shows early changes, then we would start treating the patient with medications to prevent the second attack from happening. And the data show that if you can begin treatment at the clinically isolated syndrome stage, then you can delay the development of a second attack.
And the diagnostic techniques, again, could you describe them, the MRI, CSF, and evoked potential?
So starting with the history and a neurologic examination, laboratory studies to rule out any other conditions that can mimic MS or simulate it, spinal fluid studies. Sometimes we do what are called evoked potentials, where we measure, for instance, the ray of light traveling through the optic nerves and its signal in the occipital cortex, which is one of the lobes of the brain. Spinal fluid studies to look for characteristic changes, and the MRI scan.
And the criteria for making the diagnosis of MS these days is?
There are any number of MRI criteria for making the diagnosis of MS. If one has a number of white spots in the brain, if they're located in particular areas, have a particular characteristic and distribution, and the response of these so-called lesions in the brain to gadolinium, a dye which is injected, that helps us make a diagnosis of MS.
And the lesions that you pick up, these are a result of this immune-mediated attack?
Correct.
On the myelin sheath?
On the myelin sheath, or on the axons or the neurons itself. So.
And what happens then? I'm aware that there are four different courses of multiple sclerosis. It can be progressive, it can be isolated, it can be persistent. How do you describe the courses?
So you have a person who can have clinically isolated syndrome. Then you can have what is called relapsing remitting MS, where a person may have an episode or an attack of MS. You can treat it or not treat it, and the patient returns to baseline level of functioning. And then at some point in the future, it can have another attack of MS. So this is the relapsing remitting type. With passage of time, relapsing remitting MS can change to secondary progressive. So you have an attack of MS, but you do not return to baseline. You are left with a little bit of residual deficit. And if multiple attacks occur and you're left with a little bit more deficit with each attack, then this disability accumulates and gives rise to what we call secondary progressive MS.
And then there's another type that is just progressive, just takes
this
off?
This is primary progressive MS, where there is continuous and steady decline right from the beginning. There may be brief periods of stability, and sometimes even as a patient is steadily progressing, you can have a brief superimposed relapse or an attack of MS. But there is never a period where a person goes into remission. There is no improvement.
I've heard that is more common in older people, while the relapsing remitting is more found in younger. Do you see this in your practice?
Yes. Primary progressive typically occurs in an older person, especially a man. And it affects the spinal cord. So it gives rise to a steady decline. Medications have not been found to be useful or slow the progression in this variety of MS. And fortunately, we think that primary progressive MS affects only 10% or 15% of the maximum of population. So there are not a lot of patients with this disease, but it is progressive from the very beginning.
We need to take a quick break here on Health 360 on 89.1 FM, but we'll be back in just a few moments. In the meantime, if you have a question or comment about multiple sclerosis, we'd love to hear from you. 260-452-1185 is the number, or you can post on our Facebook page or email us at middaymatters@nipr.fm. We'll be back in just a few moments here on WBOI. We'll be right back.
the next Fresh Air, the hell of American daycare. We talk with Jonathan Cohn about his cover story in the New Republic. 40% of children under 5 are in daycare, but he writes that the overall quality of daycare is wildly uneven and barely monitored, and at the lower end, it's Dickensian. Join us this afternoon at 1 here on WBOI.
The explosions in Boston rocked the country, the world, and the running community. But around the globe, the show must go on at the next big international marathon, Sunday in London, and then in Oklahoma City later this month. I'm Celeste Headlee. Public safety, securing big events, and running to remember Boston. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
This afternoon at 2 p.m. here on WBOI.
Support for this program on WBOI is provided by United Way of Allen County, offering opportunities to volunteer and make an impact on a child's life by mentoring or tutoring. UWEducationNetwork.org.
Support for this program on WBOI is provided by PHP, offering a variety of health benefits and services for individuals, families, and businesses in Northern Indiana, including medical, dental, high deductible, administrative services, and more at phpni.com.
It's 12:06. Excuse me. It's 12:29, and you're listening to 89.1 FM WBOY Fort Wayne. This is Midday Matters Health 360, and the whole program we're devoting to multiple sclerosis, the signs, symptoms, and treatment. If you have a question for Dr. Williams or Dr. Gupta, we'd love to hear from you. 260-452-1185 is the number, or you can post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters, or email us, middaymatters@nipr.fm.
Dr. Williams, it's been stated that with multiple sclerosis and the progression of the disease, we have changes in people's function in dealing with their daily life activities at home, at work, at school. How does it do this? What are the presenting factors here, and what can your department for psychological rehabilitation, occupational therapy, physical therapy, what can be done for these people? And apparently rehabilitation is an important part of the treatment.
Sure. What we generally look at or explore are not only the emotional and psychological effects on the patient, but also on the family and those relationships. We also focus a lot on, as I mentioned earlier, the cognitive changes that are going on, something that has largely been ignored for a number of years because they're more subtle. Patients with MS will often experience later on and sometimes early on changes in memory, attention span, emotional changes that may be secondary to the disease process that's going on underlying, at a cellular level, but also the adjustment issues. So our involvement is to help identify and quantify some of those changes that are going on as well, those cognitive changes. A lot of people may not realize this, but the most common reason why a person with MS applies for disability are the cognitive changes rather than the more visible physical changes to the person outside. They can be very troubling when people around you see that you have trouble walking, your coordination, they understand that. But when they can't see that you have difficulty concentrating or remembering something or expressing yourself, that's more difficult to see and more difficult to have other people understand. So we try to explore that and measure that and use that information to guide therapies, track the progression of the disease, and intervene as much as we can with that.
And the therapies that you use, it's been mentioned cognitive behavioral therapy, occupational physical therapy. What is your spectrum of therapy?
Most of the therapy that's done in our realm, counseling therapy, for the adjustment issues and the family problems, relationship problems, sexual problems between couples, those would actually be done by not our neuropsychologists. We would make referrals to people in the community who work with folks who have MS or other chronic conditions.
I think the point has been made that you don't have a loss of intellect, but your thinking is slowed down just the way the myelin damage slows down the transmission of the nerve impulses. Have you run into this, that they have trouble, the yeah. thinking process?
I think that's an excellent change. Way of characterizing it. The patient themselves feels very slowed, not only physically, but slow in their thinking, slow in their speaking, slow in their recall and memory function. Attention span. It is a slowing process, and sometimes that can be very frustrating when you're trying to retrieve a piece of information or you're trying to express something to someone else in a conversation. It also obviously affects a person's work too. Many times our evaluation is important in helping a physician or the patient determine whether some change needs to take place in their job or whether they're not able to do that job any longer.
We have a couple of folks who have called in on the program. Let's get to Don, who has an environmental question. Don, welcome to Midday Matters.
Yes, hello, everyone. And the question is concerns. I was once read in the newspaper that although some people are probably predisposed genetically to it, that environmental factors were... the result, or let us say, influenced it in a majority of cases. And this was about MS, and it was also about Parkinson's. And I was wondering if this is the case, what factors they are so that they'd best be avoided. And that's all I was going to ask you. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your question. Dr. Gupta, you touched a little bit on that earlier as far as environment and the relation to where you are in near or away from the equator, but anything else to add as far as a correlation to your environment and MS?
One has been the treatment of infections. We think that In the tropics, children suffer from a variety of infections and are not necessarily treated with antibiotics. In Western society, any infection must be thoroughly eradicated, and therefore early use of antibiotics results in sterilization and lack of development of autoimmunity. And so this has been one of the reasons that has been attributed mm-hmm. to increase MS in temperate climates. Mm-hmm.
There have been reports of clusters of MS throughout the world, and often the exposure to heavy metals or metal processing, zinc in certain cities in the United States, Rochester, Galleon, Ohio, copper, heavy metal exposure in El Paso with a lot of mining and smelting. Has there been any proof that these type of industrial environmental exposures have played any role here?
No. There is no evidence to date that any of these heavy metals have been a cause of multiple sclerosis. You will recall that at one time, mercury dental fillings was considered a cause of MS, and a whole host of people went to the dentist and got all of these fillings. And the MS Society embarked on a plan to research this and then put out a position statement saying that there is no evidence that mercury fillings increase your risk of MS or that you develop MS as a result of it.
Similarly, you may recall, or many people out there may recall, time when there was believed to be a correlation between aluminum in the brain and Alzheimer's disease. Mm. And so people started throwing away aluminum pots and pans and not drinking soda out of aluminum cans and so on. And then more research came along and found that there were plenty of Alzheimer's patients' brains that had low levels of aluminum in them. So sometimes these correlations happen and then don't pan out to be exactly causative.
Getting back to temperature and temperate climates, there is people with MS can definitely be affected by high temperatures, whether it's in, whether atmospheric or fever. What happens under those conditions?
So when the body temperature rises, the conduction in demyelinating nerves becomes slow. This has been demonstrated in what we call patch clamp techniques in the laboratory, where you can create a crush injury to a nerve muscle preparation in hot water and then try to transmit a nerve impulse through that, and you don't get a nerve impulse, or it is markedly delayed. So demyelinated nerves just do not function well under those heated conditions.
And there used to be a hot tub test for MS?
Yes. In the late 19th century, there was a test known as Uthoff's phenomenon, where a person would be immersed in a tub of warm water or hot water. And if it resulted in deteriorated vision and symptoms, then it was considered a positive test and you were diagnosed with MS.
But this is transient, and you get into a cooling situation and it goes away.
That's correct. If you get into a cool environment, the symptoms gradually resolve.
So you would recommend that people with MS be careful as to where their job transfers or family moves take them?
Yeah, we certainly caution all patients that heat can have an adverse effect on their symptoms and it can temporarily worsen symptoms. Having said that, there are always patients who will have a quite contrary experience. They feel better in hot weather. And it's not uncommon in clinical practice to come across patients who say that hot weather doesn't seem to affect me.
We need to take a quick break for the news here on Health 360 Midday Matters, but we'll be back with more of our conversation on multiple sclerosis in just a few minutes. This is 89.1 FM, WBOI Fort Wayne.
Peter Sagal here. It is so frustrating that I've been doing the show, Wait, Don't Tell Me, for so long, and I don't know what you all look like. So this is what we're going to do. We're going to simulcast our show live from New York City on May 2nd to theaters all over the country. And I want you to come to the theater. I want you to stare at the screen. And if I peer into the camera hard enough, I think I'll be able to see you. That's Wait, Don't Tell Me, live in theaters on May 2nd.
There's more information about the Wait Cinema event at NIPR.fm.
Good afternoon, I'm Sean Beter with WBOY News. A former Marine from Indiana has been sentenced to 20 years in prison after admitting he started a fire inside an Ohio mosque because he wanted revenge for the killings of American soldiers overseas. A federal judge in Toledo also ordered Randy Lynn of St. Joe, Indiana, to pay $1.4 million for the damage to the mosque. The 52-year-old Lynn apologized in court Tuesday and said he was drinking heavily before he drove to Ohio and set fire to the Islamic Center of Greater Toledo last fall. The fire caused extensive smoke and water damage throughout the building. Lynn pleaded guilty to hate crime and other charges late last year, but then tried to take back his plea. A judge turned down that request just weeks ago. A new revenue forecast predicts even stronger tax revenue growth for Indiana over the next 2 years. But as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports, House and Senate fiscal leaders say it will not dramatically alter budget negotiations.
The April revenue forecast unveiled Tuesday shows a $290 million increase from December projections, with the biggest predicted gains coming from individual income taxes. Senate Appropriations Chair Luke Kenley says the new forecast is good news, but cautioned against reading too much into it as budget negotiations progress over the next 2 weeks.
I don't think one revenue forecast changes the dynamic too much, except that it makes us all feel a little more comfortable, obviously.
Kenley and his House counterpart Tim Brown say tax cuts in the budget will likely amount to around $500 million a year, but they say that will be a mix of cuts, including the corporate tax, inheritance tax, and income tax. Governor Mike Pence's proposed tax cut would cost the state $500 million per year just in income taxes. Still, Pence says the new revenue projections indicate the state can have a budget that increases education and roads funding while providing across-the-board tax relief.
I believe that lowering income taxes by 10% is the right thing to do. And with a revenue forecast that projects $290 million more than we anticipated, I believe that it is fiscally prudent to do.
Pence also says phasing out the state's inheritance tax should be part of the final budget. Eliminating the inheritance tax, which the Senate's budget does, would cost $150 million a year. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith.
And Purdue University President Mitch Daniels is revising his proposal to freeze pay on administrative workers earning more than $50,000 to hold down tuition rates. Daniels announced on Tuesday that all employees will be eligible for 1% merit raises. Purdue will tap an account previously budgeted to retain faculty and reward top performers to supplement the money available for faculty raises. Daniels says the plan will result in $7 million in savings through 2015. The initial plan announced last month applied to senior administrators, deans, and administrative and professional staff. You're listening to Midday Matters here on WBOI.
Welcome back to Health 360 Midday Matters here on 89.1 FM WBOY Fort Wayne. It's 1242. I'm Sarah DeLia, and I'm joined in the studio this afternoon by my co-host Dr. Peter Rothman, as well as Dr. Williams and Dr. Gupta, both from the Fort Wayne Neurological Center's Multiple Sclerosis Institute. And we're talking about MS today, the signs, symptoms, and treatment. And if you have a question or comment, 260-452-1185 is the way to get your question on the air. You can always post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters, or email us, middaymatters@nipr.fm. We have Don on the line with a question. Don, thanks for holding, and welcome to Midday. Oh, it looks like we lost Don. Don, if you'd like to call back and ask your question, 260-452-1185 is the number. We did have another question from a listener who wrote in and asked, is vitamin D a good supplement that folks with MS should be consuming, and is stress-reducing exercise like yoga a good routine to be in into? Dr. Gupta, I'll ask you that question.
The answer to both of those questions is yes. Patients with MS should be consuming vitamin D.
Mm-hmm.
And yoga is an excellent form of exercise for MS patients.
Great. 260-452-1185, the number to call, or post on our Facebook page. It's Midday Matters. We wanted to switch gears in the last 15 minutes or so in our program and talk a little bit about what life is like living with MS as far as the medications that an individual would have to get used to taking. So, Dr. Gupta, what is there a typical medication that you first prescribe to patients? Or
there is no typical medication. So in the last 30 years, probably a little less than 30 years, we now have 9 medications that have been approved by the FDA. An oral medication was approved approximately 2 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
So this makes the treatment of MS very exciting, but the treatment has to be individualized. The physician must enter into a conversation with each patient, and it has to be a partnership. The treatment is lifelong, and the treatment has many side effects which need to be monitored. And therefore, you look at each patient's particular circumstances and lifestyles and see what is the best option for that patient. The goal of treatment is to slow the progression of the disease and to give patients the best quality of life that current treatment regimens will offer.
And it's been stated that these are disease-modifying medications and not necessarily cures. And this is the case, and patients should understand this as they go into therapy.
Correct. So these are long-term treatments, and that's the whole idea, is to modify the disease. There are symptomatic treatments which may be given for the treatment of individual symptoms. Taking disease-modifying therapies may not improve any of the existing symptoms. It is intended to have a long-term effect on the course of the disease.
How do these medications work on the neurological system?
In a nutshell, all of them are anti-inflammatory. So the whole idea is to shift the immune system from one that promotes inflammation to one that suppresses inflammation. More recently, medications have become available that raise the possibility of neuroprotection. So that is an exciting area for neurologists to be in. If we can come up with neuroprotective therapies so that the neurons and the oligodendrocytes are preserved and are not destroyed in the process, then that would be a major advance for the treatment of MS. The second option would be if we can come up with medications that can do remyelination would be an option. The problem that we have is to determine what is the readout of these treatments. If there is a drug that promotes remyelination, how do I detect that remyelination? What is the test that I do that'll help me prove that the drug is remyelinating within the nervous system? If there is a neuroprotective effect, what is the readout? What is the paradigm that I have that'll tell me that the drug truly is behaving as a neuroprotection?
Would you not see any improvement on the MRI scans?
But that's the whole question. Will we or won't we? And what is the MRI actually showing us?
We have a couple of folks on the line that we need to get to before the end of the show. Looks like we have Tom on line one who has a question about MS and its relation to the spine. Tom, welcome to Midday Matters. Oh, we lost Tom. We do have Amanda on the line who had a question about eyesight and MS. Amanda, welcome to Midday Matters.
Hello.
You can go on with your question.
Okay.
Amanda, it looks like we've lost you. A bad connection there. Amanda did write in her question, though, before getting on the phone. It looks from what she wrote in, it sounds like she's recently lost a significant portion of vision in her right eye and wondering if it's time for a trip to the optometrist or to get checked out for MS. Is there a guess for... Regardless, it looks like she needs to go to a doctor right away.
Absolutely. Without a doubt, she needs to see an ophthalmologist rather than an optometrist, and definitely see her family physician and then get referred to the specialist for a complete workup.
Mm-hmm. And do that sooner rather than later.
Exactly. Has to be soon. Yeah.
As is what I'm taking away from this show today with MS, is life can be significantly better if caught prematurely.
Yes, the emphasis is early diagnosis and early treatment.
What are the barriers to treatment? And perhaps Dr. Williams could talk about this. With adherence to the medication regimen, the fact that they may not see immediate results, the side effects, how difficult is it for your institute to keep people on therapy and look towards the future, not tomorrow?
Of course, it's completely variable from one patient to the next as to how comfortable they are and how they adjust to the diagnosis and the idea of taking medication. And some of the ways that medication is administered is not particularly pleasant, through injections or whatever. Sometimes the side effects are very frustrating for patients. And each person adapts to that in a different way. And I think that the methods of delivery and the side effects can be a real barrier. On top of that, you have stigma. That's a part of any illness and any chronic illness. Many times that people don't want to see themselves as this chronic illness patient or having this particular disease. And so one of the ways that a person can try to adapt to that or handle that is ignore it or deny it, and then therefore miss out on treatment for quite a while that could be very helpful in delaying the progression of the disease.
Yeah, we used to see patients who would go through a phase of denial, anger, and then acceptance. And as they go through these emotions and phases, you lose many years.
And even though MS is a progressive disease, it's been stated that maybe 1.5 relapses per year on the average. So people could go through periods where they feel pretty good And do you sense a tendency to want to get off treatment or not think they need to continue, even though they don't feel that there's a continuing process?
This is a continuing battle with patients to emphasize that they must adhere to the treatment so they can go for very long periods of time without having any symptoms, only to see the disease start to progress in the 12th year or the 15th year and so forth.
And you have seen with these newer medications that have been about in the last 10, 15 years, less relapses, less debilitation?
Yes, absolutely. We see much less severe relapses. It is very rare for us to admit a patient to the hospital for treatment of an MS relapse, and most of these can be done on an outpatient basis.
What is the long-term prognosis for patients with MS in terms of longevity and being able to walk? To what age can they expect a certain degree of reasonable function?
So we still define MS as a progressive disease. So in spite of all of the advances in treatment and so forth, the vast majority of patients will still show progression. In terms of longevity, the best data we have is from a Danish registry, which showed that MS decreases lifespan by 10 years. We are not sure that with the modern treatments that we have shifted this lifespan.
And in the past, before the modern medications, supposedly 50-60% of patients with the relapsing remitting disease would eventually go into the secondary progressive form. But have you seen yet that you can prevent that progression into more progressive disease with these new meds?
Well, patients certainly transition from relapsing remitting to a secondary progressive phase. And what I have found is that even when they're in the secondary progressive phase and taking these medications, their ability to cope is better than a patient who did not take any treatment at all. And so while the disease is progressive, their quality of life is still significantly better than those that did not take any treatment.
And Dr. Williams, do you see this from your perspective, that people on medication who are following or adhering to the regimen, do you see definite improvement in their psychological and social function?
Over the long haul, yes, and that's the key there. They've got to stick with this program over the long haul. They'll see the difference. Sometimes you get the compliance problems because the person is not immediately seeing the benefit in symptoms from the medicine that they're taking. It's hard sometimes for them to see the long-term benefits and how it will affect their lives in the long range.
We had a listener write in with a question asking, are there any related spinal symptoms to MS because they've been experiencing some spine tingling and has an appointment to go to the doctor, but wanted to know if spine tingling is a possible symptom or any pain in the spine a symptom of MS?
Pain in the spine is not per se a symptom of MS, and I must confess that I do not fully understand tingling in the spine. However, if there are lesions in the spinal cord, especially the spinal cord in the neck that we call cervical cord, bending the neck forward can sometimes give rise to an electric shock-like sensation that goes down through the body into the legs. A sign that we call Lhermitte's sign, that was named after a Frenchman. And there can be lesions in other parts of the spinal cord where you get what we call girdle paresthesias. You find a band-like sensation around your waist or under the breast that feels constricting and it feels as if you cannot breathe well.
I think the point has been made that this is a disease of the central nervous system rather than the peripheral nervous system. The central includes
the spinal cord.
And the brain.
And the brain,
the optic,
yes.
Optic nerves.
Yes.
What services are offered by the MS Institute of Fort Wayne Neurological Center? Do you have support groups? Do you have nurse practitioners? What is the total, once someone becomes a patient of the Institute, what would they expect and what's available to them?
So at our center, we are a comprehensive MS center. So from diagnosis and management and laboratory workup, MRI scans, neuropsychologic support, we have a whole host of therapists to assist patients in collaboration with the local hospital and a research department. We have a very active research program, so if patients are interested in research and they meet the various inclusion and exclusion criteria for participating in research, they have that opportunity. So I think we have a whole host of services for MS patients.
And this is they in turn develop a long-term relationship with this institute, not just a diagnostic visit.
Correct. We will continue to follow all MS patients at our center.
I think it's also important to note that it's very much a collaborative thing, not just within our center, but with supporting groups, agencies, professionals outside in the community. The MS Society, for example, the importance of working with speech and language therapists, physical therapists, and services like that to help these folks.
We have just about a minute and a half left in today's program. So, Dr. Williams, I'll start with you. Any last words that you'd hope our listeners would take away from today's conversation on MS?
Well, purely from my specialty and my special interest, it would be the to pay attention to the cognitive changes. Don't ignore them. They can affect your life in a very profound way and oftentimes be more devastating than some of the physical changes for some patients who have MS. And get those addressed as soon and identified and addressed as soon as possible.
And Dr. Gupta?
Everybody must understand that MS, the treatment of MS, is a collaborative effort between patients, their families, and physicians and providers. It is a long-term disease. There is no cure for it. And one must constantly communicate between the patient and the physician.
Dr. Gupta and Dr. Williams of the Fort Wayne Neurological Center's Multiple Sclerosis Institute, thank you both so much for joining us today for Health 360.
Thank you for having
us.
Support for Midday Matters on WBOY is provided by Cameron Memorial Community Hospital, providing health and wellness services in the spirit of charity, concern, and excellence. Serving Steuben County and surrounding areas. Information at CameronMCH.com. And this is Northeast Indiana Public Radio, broadcasting from the Madge Rothschild Studios at 89.1 HD Channel 1. We're streaming online at NIPR.FM. This is WBOY Fort Wayne and WBKE North Manchester, a service of Manchester University. We're coming up on 1 o'clock and Fresh Air is just moments away. And a reminder that WBOY's Spring Fun Drive starts this Saturday. And if you'd like to volunteer to help answer phones, we'd love to have you. You can check out the schedule at NIPR.FM. And thanks very much. Thanks for listening. Hope you have a great rest of your day. It's 1 o'clock.